This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Don't Vote, It Just Encourages the Bastards by P.J. O'Rourke, performed by Christopher Lane. To my wife, Christina, for her encouragement of this particular bastard and for not imposing term limits. Apologia pro expletive sua. I beg forgiveness from the reader for the vulgar language in this book. Politics is a vulgar fucking subject. I have resorted to barnyard words because of the amount of bullshit, horseshit, and chicken shit involved in politics. I'm sorry I can't devise a more polite mode of expression. I can only blame myself. It is possible, I suppose, to take a decorous approach to politics, but I'm reminded of the American guest at a dinner in one of the great houses of Britain. The American was seated to the left of a very grand and fat old duchess, and an Englishman was seated on her right. During the soup course, the duchess farted. The Englishman, taking chivalrous responsibility, said, "I beg your pardon." During the fish course, the duchess farted again, louder than before. Once more, the Englishman said, "I beg your pardon." Then, during the meat course, the duchess cut loose with a tremendous, resounding blast. The Englishman said, "I beg—" "No, no," the American interrupted. "This one's on me." Part 1. The Sex, Death, and Boredom Theory of Politics. The man of system is apt to be very wise in his own conceit, and is often so enamored with the supposed beauty of his own ideal plan of government that he cannot suffer the smallest deviation from any part of it. Adam Smith. Scientific socialism would hold a special attraction for intellectuals by promising to replace spontaneous and messy life with a rational order of which they would be the interpreters and mentors. Richard Pipes. Here's a good rule of thumb. Too clever is dumb. Ogden Nash. 1. Kill, fuck, marry. Having been a political commentator of one kind or another since 1970, it has occurred to me to ask, what the hell have I been talking about for 40 years? It's a surprisingly difficult question to answer. One subject has been power, the skull beneath the skin of politics. Sometimes we get flayed completely, and there's nothing left but a pile of skulls. Then there's freedom. From my addlepated hippie youth to my right-wing grouch maturity, I've been a fan of freedom, particularly my own. Furthermore, because I've always lived in a nation that is self-ruled, if often by selfish selves, and that is under the rule of law, if often legally unruly, responsibility, too, has been a topic, although I dislike taking any. Power, freedom, and responsibility are the trinity of politics in a free and democratic country, but it's hard to know how to go about understanding this triad. We are so passionate about our politics. And how do passionate affairs end? In a passion, usually. In a crime of passion, sometimes. Occasionally, they turn into stable, permanent, connubial relationships, which is to say, endless, peevish quarrels. How should the political institutions of America be approached? Do we overthrow them with violence? Do we screw around with them while they screw around with us? Or do we try to build something that's lasting and boring, worthy and annoying, marvelously virtuous and at the same time dreadfully stifling? No wonder most of my fellow political commentators and I have preferred to rave about politics rather than consider them. It's human nature, at least among free and democratic humans, to be angry, confused, and instinctual about politics. So how do we go about creating a set of political principles that don't suck? We need a reasonable, reasonably precise, and reasonably well-reasoned way to look at political institutions, political policies, and politicians. There is ample evidence of what happens when such principles are lacking. Somalia. Power, freedom, and responsibility are not principles in and of themselves. They're perspectives. But we can use these three ways of looking at things to analyze politics. The game Kill, Fuck, Marry comes to us, as far as anyone can tell, from late-night giggle sessions at all-girls boarding schools. Take three political institutions that seem to occupy different vertices in the triangulation of power, freedom, and responsibility. Or, because it's more fun, take three politicians. For instance, the Kennedy brothers, charismatic Jack, conscientious Bobby, and Teddy with a lampshade on his head. Obviously, we kill Ted, fuck Jack, and marry Bobby. If choosing among martyred plus cancer-stricken Kennedys seems tasteless, we can use the 1992 U.S. presidential candidates, who, for example's sake, were exemplary. We kill Ross Perot. We could hardly avoid a fuck from Bill Clinton. And we marry kindly old George H.W. Bush. The game's outcome is not always certain, per our mysterious elopement with Bill instead of our church wedding with George. In the case of the 2000 presidential election, people of goodwill were evenly divided about whether to fuck Al Gore or marry George W., although I believe we all agreed on killing Ralph Nader. I won't venture any answers involving more recent elections for fear of attracting attention, hard as that sometimes seems, from the Secret Service. But the game works on the parts of government as well as it does on the politicians who run them. We kill the Postal Service, fuck the Department of Health and Human Services, and marry the armed forces. The same goes with government policies. Fuck agricultural subsidies, marry Social Security, and health care reform kills us. Try kill, fuck, marry at your next cocktail party if you want the people you invited never to speak to one another again. 2. Politics makes us free, and we're worth it. When I first began to think about politics, when Mastodons and Nixon roamed the earth, I was obsessed with freedom. I had a messy idea of freedom at the time, but I had the tidy idea that freedom was the central issue of politics. I loved politics. Many young people do. Kids can spot a means of gain without merit. This may be the reason professional politicians retain a certain youthful zest. Strom Thurmond was the boyo right down to his last senile moment. I was wrong about the lovable nature of politics, and even at 23, I probably suspected I was wrong. But I was sure I was right about the preeminent place of freedom in a political system. Freedom is a personal ideal. Because politics is an arrangement among persons, we can plausibly assume that freedom is a political ideal. Our favorite political idealists think so. They've been unanimous on the subject since Jean-Jacques Rousseau convinced polite society that human bondage was in bad taste, and John Locke showed the divine right of kings to be a royal pain. The signers of the Declaration of Independence declared us to be residents of free and independent states. John Adams demanded, "Let me have a country, and that a free country." Tom Paine warned that freedom hath been hunted round the globe, and he exhorted us to receive the fugitive and prepare in time an asylum for mankind. Calling America an asylum may have been a poor choice of words, or not. Thomas Jefferson, in his first inaugural address, preached freedom of religion, freedom of the press, and freedom of person. Jefferson was quite free with the person of Sally Hemings. And a dinner toast from Revolutionary War General John Stark bestowed upon New Hampshire a license plate motto that must puzzle advocates of highway safety: live free or die. With Bartlett's familiar quotations as a useful gauge of what we think, we find that Emerson poetized, "For what avail the plow or sail, or land or life, if freedom fail?" Hegel weighed in, "The history of the world is none other than the progress of the consciousness of freedom." As unlikely a character as the crackpot Nietzsche had something to say. Liberal institutions straightway cease from being liberal the moment they are soundly established. Once this is attained, no more grievous and more thorough enemies of freedom exist than liberal institutions. The UN Commission on Human Rights comes to mind. We can survey the arts, where mankind is most blatant in its truths, and find artists taking the broadest liberties. They are especially free with the use of fate as a plot device. We can peruse philosophy where mankind is less truthful, and not hear freedom denied by anything except free thinking. Theology makes sporadic arguments against free will, with which the devout are freely willing to concur. Science is deterministic, and its special needs stepsister, social science, is more so. But people are free to pick and choose among the determinations of science until they find something they like. I give you Al Gore, and you can have him. Perhaps there are scientists who make a sound case for the inevitabilities of biology and such, but we don't know what these geniuses are talking about, and very likely neither do they. For example, the important biologist Richard Dawkins has written a book, The God Delusion, in which he uses predestinarian atheism to argue that Richard Dawkins is the closest thing to a superior being in the known universe. The theoretical, as opposed to practical, enemies of freedom are feeble opponents. And we are all but overrun by theoretical allies in freedom's cause. We've got collaborators in the fight for freedom that we don't even want. The proletarians have nothing to lose but their chains, is the penultimate sentence of the Communist Manifesto, and a creepy echo of it can be heard in the refrain of Kris Kristofferson's Me and Bobby McGee. Mao announced, "Letting 100 flowers blossom and 100 schools of thought contend is the policy, ... Half a million people died in those ellipses. If we were to give out the proverbial a word to the wise, the sagacity-testing utterance with which to provide the sages would be freedom. In the unabridged Oxford English Dictionary, the noun has 15 definitions, and the adjective free has 36. These definitions, along with their usage citations, occupy 189 and one-quarter column inches of small and smaller type. Peter Roget, 1779 to 1869, of Roget's Thesaurus, was a physician, a scientist, the secretary of the Royal Society for more than 20 years, and an exhaustingly systematic thinker. He designed his thesaurus, Greek for treasury, as a reverse dictionary. Instead of listing words and giving their meanings, he listed meanings and gave words for them. Under the heading Freedom, there are more than 400 entries in 21 categories. And Freedom is only one of the 23 headings in Roget's Section 1, General Intersocial Volition, of Division 2, Intersocial Volition, of Class 5, Volition. It's hard to know whether or not to be thankful that Peter Roget's obsessive-compulsive disorder meds hadn't been invented. Among the various types and kinds of general intersocial volition, about 10 have something to do with political freedom. Freedom in the abstract, autonomy, enfranchisement, toleration, frankness, leisure, laxity, abandon, opportunity, privilege. Several of these may seem beside the point, but frank, for instance, is from the old French franc, meaning free. We can be frank with the President of the United States. We can honestly and openly say what we think to him, and what we think of him. But in all our name-calling, the name we call our President that sticks is Mr. He's not Your Excellency or Your Highness, nor do we kowtow, genuflect, or curtsy to him. Callisthenes, the great-nephew of Aristotle, plotted to kill Alexander the Great rather than prostrate himself in the Persian manner to the conqueror of the known world. It's probably just as well that our current president foregoes even a handshake with Fox News. Then there are the freedoms of leisure, laxity, and wild abandon. Anyone who thinks these have nothing to do with democracy hasn't met the demos. Also, it was not so long ago, during the great political demonstrations of the 1960s, that I was risking my neck, well, risking a conch on the head and a snootful of tear gas, in the battle to create a utopian society where I could lie around all day, utterly heedless and high as a kite. Freedom, of course, may be considered as an abstraction. I was young enough to be highly abstracted, not to say stoned, when I began to think about freedom, but I wasn't old enough to think. Therefore, I can tell you nothing about my abstract thinking on the subject, and so can't a lot of other people because there are languages in which the word freedom doesn't exist. Not surprising if you think about some of the places languages are spoken. Richard Pipes, emeritus professor of Russian history at Harvard, who is fluent in a number of tongues himself, makes this point in his book Property and Freedom, a perspicacious analysis of what the title says. Professor Pipes cites the work of M. I. Finley, preeminent historian of classical antiquity, and, incidentally, a Marxist, something Richard Pipes is the opposite of. Finley wrote, "It is impossible to translate the word freedom. Eleutheris in Greek, libertas in Latin, or free man into any ancient Near Eastern language, including Hebrew, or into any Far Eastern language either, for that matter." Indeed, when the Japanese first encountered Western notions, they were hard put to translate freedom and ended up using the word jiyū, which means something like getting jiggy with it. Freedom and liberty themselves don't have quite the same meaning. Free is derived from the Indo-European root pri, to love. The P becomes F in Germanic languages, thus free in Old German and frio in Old English. The original sense of the adjective was dear, and it was used to describe those members of a household who had a kinship relation to the master of the house. Since at least the reign of King Alfred the Great, ruled 871 to 899, the primary definition of free has been not in bondage. You're free because who loves you, baby? Liberty is probably the better word. Its source is in the Indo-European lude, to mount up, grow. Hence Latin for children, liberi, and German for populace, luta. We the people make lude into eleutheris and libertas. Footnote. But freedom is less highfalutin and more of an Americanism. Theodore Parker, a prominent abolitionist, may be partly responsible for the American usage. He is certainly responsible for the American definition of democracy. Parker gave a series of speeches in Boston in the 1850s. Abraham Lincoln's law partner, William Herndon, attended one of these talks and gave the following transcript to Lincoln to obvious effect. "A democracy, that is, a government of all the people, by all the people, for all the people, of course, a government of the principles of eternal justice, the unchanging law of God, for shortness' sake, I will call it the idea of freedom." End note. Yet the first definition of liberty in English is, once again, exemption or release from bondage. Whatever we mean by our abstract statements about freedom and liberty, the most meaningful thing we're stating is that mankind has a sickening history of slavery. Enfranchisement is the lively, fortunate, and honorable freedom, for the sake of which our political ancestors pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. Nothing concerning the goal of enfranchisement is ignoble except its attainment. Among those who choose, the congressmen, senators, and presidents of the United States, we now include people who are not considered mature and responsible enough to have a beer. If it's any comfort, we should remind ourselves of the purpose of voting. We don't vote to elect great persons to office. They're not that great. We vote to throw the bastards out. Toleration is the best comfort of a free life for most people most of the time, especially if they experience as well as practice it. But tolerance is of minor interest to politics. Politics aspires to a big positive role in things, and the role of politics in toleration is small except in the usually negative actions of keeping the peace. Yet it was two consummate American politicians who supplied us with a model for the universal formulation of tolerance. Mind your own business and keep your hands to yourself. These may be rightly called the Bill and Hillary Clinton rules. Hillary, mind your own business. Bill, keep your hands to yourself. The ontological freedom known as autonomy isn't part of practical politics. It's all of practical politics, imposing my will and thwarting yours. If the actions of mankind and the events of history turn out to have been foreordained, it will be a good joke on politics. This leaves us with the nub or butt end of politicking, privilege and opportunity. Ignore everything politicians say about opportunity. They're lying. When politicians tout opportunity, either they are trying to help voters disguise an extortion as a gift, or they are the groom of government complimenting the bride of private property while in bed with the socialist maid of honor. And ignore all the politicians sniffing at and scorn for privilege. Privilege and opportunity are the names for rights. Opportunity being rights you'd like to get, and privilege being rights you'd like someone else to surrender. A politician doesn't ask if he may have the privilege of a dance. He says he has the right to it. Our gassing about our rights is almost equal to our gassing about our freedoms when we're bent over and puffed full of air concerning our form of government. We're inordinately proud of the Bill of Rights, but it's an odd document. The First and Sixth Amendments are straightforward enough, reassuring us that we may pray, OMG, Twitter, kvetch, and be tried in the same court as O.J. Simpson. And the Fifth Amendment says that when we screw up big time, we don't have to give our version, like anybody's going to believe us. But the Second Amendment is woefully confusing. Not that it confuses me about gun ownership, in case you were considering a mugging to get my jitterbug mobile phone. The principal right that the Second Amendment seems to guarantee is the right to be a soldier. To judge by our various episodes of national conscription, Civil War, World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, this is a right we sometimes have to force people to enjoy. According to the Third Amendment, the Pentagon can't just randomly send the U.S. Marines to sleep on our fold-out couch. This is something that, as a homeowner, you'd think would be obvious. Although, in fairness, there are people elsewhere who wish they had an amendment keeping the Marines out of their house. The Third Amendment and the Seventh Amendment, concerning jury appeals, are undercut by weasel words, but in a manner to be prescribed by law, and otherwise than according to the rules of the common law. The Fourth Amendment, mandating warrants, and the Eighth Amendment, limiting punishments, include strange pairs of modifiers, unreasonable and probable, cruel and unusual, better suited to a drunken description of my first marriage than to a sober writ of law. And the message of the Ninth and Tenth Amendments is, you have other rights, but you have to guess what they are. There was opposition to the Bill of Rights. The modern mind expects it to have come from slave owners, but this is too modern. Support for the first 10 amendments had little to do with dictionary definitions of freedom and liberty, and a great deal to do with qualms that old-line revolutionary patriots, including Sam Adams, had about the new federal government. Alexander Hamilton, who had other qualms, made a case against the Bill of Rights in that supposed urtext of American freedoms, the Federalist Papers, in number 84. Hamilton put forth various arguments opposing the addition of any Bill of Rights to the U.S. Constitution. Some of the arguments were weak. Hamilton claimed that the Constitution as it was affirmed and maintained the ancient protections of individual liberty embodied in British common law. Maybe. But a less dangerous and expensive way to retain British common law had been available in 1776. Hamilton claimed that previous precedent-setting bills of rights, starting with the Magna Carta, were merely bargains between a sovereign and his subjects about a ruler's prerogatives. Hamilton felt that no such sharp dealing and unseemly horse trading was necessary in a social contract freely made among equals. But if Nietzsche was right about what liberal institutions do once they're institutionalized, and there's no evidence he wasn't, then Hamilton was wrong. And Hamilton believed the Constitution already included the most important safeguards of freedom, establishment of habeas corpus, prohibition of ex post facto laws, and a ban on titles of nobility. Hamilton was listing the principal instruments in the tyranny tool chest of his era. He didn't foresee the future inventions of oppression such as ethnic cleansing, even though ethnic cleansing of North America was well underway at the time the Federalist essays were written. But Hamilton's other objections to the Bill of Rights were prescient. "Don't give the government ideas," he warned. "Why, for instance, should it be said that the liberty of the press shall not be restrained when no power is given by which restrictions may be imposed? I will not contend that such a provision would confer a regulating power, but it is evident that it would furnish, to men disposed to usurp, a plausible pretense for claiming that power. They might urge, 'The provision against restraining the liberty of the press afforded a clear implication that a power to prescribe proper regulations concerning it was intended to be vested in the national government.'" And now we have not only the FCC's naughty involvement in Janet Jackson's wardrobe malfunction, but also the gross obscenities of binding and gagging displayed in America's campaign finance legislation. Footnote. Although, as I write, the Supreme Court has overruled some of this legislation, corporations as legal persons turn out to have the same rights to free speech as we personal persons. Corporations are people? Who knew? This may explain how I got screwed by British Petroleum the other night after a few too many drinks at the Capitol Grill. End note. Hamilton said that, in the matter of defining a right, who can give it any definition which would not leave the utmost latitude for evasion? Not even God, if you note the various evasions practiced by believers since Genesis. Hamilton said the true security of our freedom must altogether depend on public opinion and on the general spirit of the people and of the government. Each of these can be rotten, and occasionally all of them are. Such an occasion arose just 7 years after the Bill of Rights was ratified. The Sedition Act made it a federal crime to publish anything about Congress or the President that would bring them into contempt or disrepute. In other words, the Sedition Act made it a federal crime to publish anything about Congress or the President. Fortunately, the Bill of Rights is flawed in its treatment of only one type of rights, opportunities. It doesn't meddle with the other type, privileges. Perhaps these two categories of rights should be known as get-out-of-here rights and gimme rights, or, as they're more usually called in political theory, negative rights and positive rights. The Bill of Rights, and the idea of freedom, is concerned mostly with our liberty to say, "I've got God, guns, and a big damn mouth, and if the jury finds me guilty, the judge will pay my bail." This is a negative right, our right to be left alone, our freedom from interference, usually from government, but also from our fellow citizens when they want us to sober up, quit yelling, put the shotgun down, and go back into the house. Politicians in their hearts are always tepid supporters of get-out-of-here rights. For one thing, any and all legislators are being invited to leave. For another thing, strict adherence to negative rights would leave little scope for legislating, something legislators dearly love to do. Gimme rights are more politically alluring. This is how we find ourselves tempted with positive rights to education, housing, health care, a living wage, flood relief, high-speed internet access, and all the kingdoms of the world and all the glory of them. Politicians show no signs of even knowing the difference between negative and positive rights. Blinded by the dazzle of anything that makes them popular, they honestly may not be able to tell. But there's evidence that a confusion of negative and positive rights originally was presented to the public with malice aforethought. President Franklin Roosevelt's Four Freedoms appear to be, at first glance, as natural, well-matched, and tidy of composition as the Norman Rockwell illustrations for them. 1. Freedom of speech and expression. 2. Freedom of religion. 3. Freedom from want. 4. Freedom from fear. But notice how the beggar, number 3, has been slipped in among the more respectable members of the freedom family. Want what? We ask ourselves. Saying, as Roosevelt did in his January 6, 1941 State of the Union address, that we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms, and that one of these freedoms is freedom from want, was not an expression of generosity. Declarations of positive rights never are. There were 6 million Jews in Europe who wanted nothing but a safe place to go. Politicians are careless about promising positive rights and cynical about delivering them. Positive rights themselves, in turn, are absurdly expandable. The government gives me a right to get married. This shows I have a right to a good marriage. Otherwise, why bother giving it to me? My marriage is made a lot better by my children's right to daycare, so the brats aren't in my face all day being deprived of their right to a nurturing developmental environment. Every child has the right to a happy childhood, so I have the right to happy children. Richer children are happier. Give me some of Angelina Jolie's. The expense of all this makes politicians glad. They get to do the spending. Even negative rights aren't free. They entail a military, a constabulary, a judiciary, and a considerable expenditure of patience by our neighbors. But positive rights require no end of money, and money is the least of their cost. Every positive right means the transfer of goods and services from one group of citizens to another. The first group of citizens loses those goods and services, but all citizens lose the power that must be given to a political authority to enforce the transfer. Perhaps such transfers could be made voluntary. U.S. federal personal income tax receipts in 2008, $1,426,000,000,000. U.S. charitable contributions in 2008, $307,700,000. Perhaps not. When rights consist of special privileges and material benefits, rights kill freedom. Wrong rights are the source of political power. It's not freedom, but power that is the central issue in politics. Only an idiot wouldn't have seen that. And I was one. At least I wasn't alone. In the latter two-thirds of the 20th century, most of us who involved ourselves in democratic politics claimed that freedom was what we were up to. We claimed it for more than 50 years, from the time of our defeat in the Spanish Civil War until the embarrassing moment when those authoritarians Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher led us to victory in the Cold War. Liberals, moderates, and even some conservatives considered the sweeping positive rights created by a half-century of social welfare programs to be extensions of freedom, in the opportunity sense. People were being given the opportunity to, you know, not starve to death and stuff. This wasn't an evil way of looking at things, and not all the programs were bad. But the electorate, the candidates, and we busybody pundits, failed to properly scrutinize social welfare programs. It's not that we failed to examine whether the programs were needed, or superfluous, or well or poorly run. What we failed to look at was the enormous power being taken from persons and given to politics. We insisted on seeing politics through the lens of freedom, as if social legislation were a Polaroid print of quickly developing liberties. We listened only to the freedom track on the electoral stereo. We predicted the future of politics with a horoscope containing just the astrological sign Libra. We weren't exactly wrong. Living in the midst of the civil rights struggle during a Cold War with one totalitarian ideology after a real war with another, we understood the value of freedom and the ugly alternative to democracy. But we didn't, or didn't want to, understand power. This was particularly true of my age cohort, the baby boom, and particularly evident in the way we reacted when politicians attempted to use their power to limit our freedom by conscripting us into a war in Vietnam. We challenged the establishment by growing our hair long and dressing like Bozo. We're a pathetic bunch, and it didn't start with the Beatles, marijuana, and the pill. Recall the coonskin cap. I wore mine to school. Children of previous eras may have worn coonskin caps, but they had to eat the raccoons first. The baby boom's reluctance to attend to the issues of power resulted from the fact that we had some. Freedom is power, after all. And as for freedom, we were full of it. We were the first middle-class majority generation in history. We had the varieties of freedom that affluence provides, Plus, we had the other varieties of freedom provided by relaxation of religious convictions, sexual morality, etiquette, and good taste. The social institutions that enforce prudence and restraint had been through a world war, prohibition, depression, a World War Part II, and Elvis. They were tired. We were allowed to fall under the power of our own freedoms, and we powered through them. 60 years on, we're still at it, letting not age, satiety, tedium, or erectile dysfunction stand in our way. Yet always at our back we hear the nagging thought that power comes with responsibility. We don't want that. Has there ever been a generation, a nation, a civilization more determined to evade responsibility? Probably. The ancient Romans sliced open animals and rummaged in their kidneys and livers in an attempt to avoid owning up to the consequences of empire and toga parties. The Greeks were forever running off to hear the irresponsible babble of the oracle at Delphi, the Larry King of her age. Maybe the Egyptians had an Oprah barge on the Nile where deceased pharaohs could fall to pieces and promise to become better mummies. Nonetheless, we and our contemporaries in the developed countries of the Western world have an impressive record of blame-shifting, duty-shirking, unaccountability, and refusal to admit guilt, or, better, to readily confess to every kind of guilt, then announce we've moved on. A gigantic global not-my-fault project has been undertaken with heroic amounts of time, effort, and money devoted to psychology, psychotherapy, sociology, sociopaths, social work, social sciences, Scientology, science, chemistry, the brain, brain chemistry, serotonin reuptake inhibitors, inhibitions, sex, sex therapy, talk radio personalities, personality disorders, drugs, drug-free school zones, internet addiction, economics, the Fed, PMS, SATs, IQ, DNA, evolution, abortion, divorce, no-fault car insurance, the Democratic Party, diagnosis of attention deficit disorder in small boys. The list goes on. Neither freedom nor power is what I should have been obsessed with for all these years, but it's too late now. I'm a child of my era. And speaking of that era, here are three slogans from 1960s posters that never existed. Black responsibility, sisterhood is responsible, responsibility to the people. 3. A digression on happiness. American exceptionalism annoys the world. Happiness is the source of the annoyance. Other countries are built upon battle, blood, nationality, culture, language, and territory. America is the exception. Our foundation is pursuit of happiness. It appears in the first sentence of the main body of America's IPO, the Declaration of Independence. Happiness is the one novel feature of the document. And this imaginative mission statement, that we are determined to pursue happiness, comes as something of a surprise after the noble boilerplate of our calls for life and liberty. We can explore mankind's other covenants, treaties, conventions, protocols, compacts, and concordants, plus all the corpus juris of the world, written and unwritten, ancient and modern, and not find happiness. No talk of happiness appears in England's Magna Carta. The French Revolution's Declaration of the Rights of Man fails to address the subject. The European Union's proposed constitution never mentions happiness, although at 485 pages it mentions practically everything else, including regulatory specifications concerning edible meat offal and lard and other rendered pig fat. The Lisbon Treaty that took the place of the rejected EU Constitution doesn't supply this want of happiness. The UN's Universal Declaration of Human Rights does state, in Article 24, that everyone has the right to rest and leisure, including periodic holidays with pay. Leave it to UN delegates to expect to be paid for their freedom. Anyway, a holiday is not the same as the pursuit of happiness, as anyone knows who spent a holiday dragging whiny children on a tour of UN headquarters. The New Testament, arguably the founding text of Western civilization, mentions happiness just 7 times, and never in a happy context. Peter's first epistle to persecuted Christians in Asia Minor, says, "If ye suffer for righteousness' sake, happy are ye." Jesus is quoted as using the word happy only once, on the occasion of washing his disciples' feet. We admire the Son of Man, but we sons of a gun who populate America do not pursue our happiness in this manner. The United States is the first, and so far only, among happy nations. "Happy the people whose annals are blank in history books," wrote Thomas Carlyle. Just ask Americans a question about American history, watch them draw a blank, and you'll see that we are the happy people indeed. Not that Americans seem very happy at the moment, and maybe Americans never have seemed happy. In his 1741 sermon, "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God," Jonathan Edwards doesn't sound as if he's talking to a cheery crowd. "The God that holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some loathsome insect over the fire, abhors you. He looks upon you as worthy of nothing else but to be cast into the fire." And now, due to the financial crisis, the mortgage foreclosure crisis, and health care reform, we're not only going to hell, we're broke, homeless, and sick while we're waiting to get in. Happiness, like the freedom we're so happy to have, is elusive, slippery in physical and conceptual grasp. "I'm happy" doesn't mean I'm having fun. Remember all the fun you've had. When it was really fun, it didn't end up making anybody very happy. "I'm happy" is distinct from those spasms of ecstasy that do not elicit any coherent phrases. "I'm happy" is more or less equivalent to "I'm content," which means, "I won't complain because nobody listens to me." "Happy" is often used as a none-too-complimentary modifier. Happy-go-lucky, slap-happy, happy horseshit, happy as a pig insane. The catchphrases "one big happy family," "is everybody happy," and "I hope you're happy now" are never spoken without a happy smirk of irony. Then there's whatever John Lennon was getting at with "happiness is a warm gun." Although it's true under certain circumstances. Try defending the perimeter of your outpost in Kandahar by squeezing a puppy. However, it should be noted that the Declaration of Independence reads, "Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness," not "life, liberty, and whoopee." Jefferson's choosing "the pursuit of" rather than plain "happiness" is a reminder of what happens to the poor suckers who, in their pursuit of happiness, catch the thing. America's legions of minor, temporary tabloid stars can tell the rest of the story, if they survive their stardom. Happiness is hard to attain, harder to maintain, and hardest of all, to recognize. Pick the time of your life when you were happiest. You didn't know how happy you were at the time. When the kids were little and you hadn't slept in 3 years, that first job in Manhattan, being groped by the assistant marketing director and sharing a one-bedroom Avenue X and Millionth Street apartment with 11 other people, those halcyon days at college that you flunked out of. Old people are forever reminiscing happily about all sorts of things that wouldn't seem conducive to happiness, such as World War II. Will the forsaken recipients of largesse from bilked charities someday wax nostalgic about Bernie Madoff's avuncular ways? The fact that we don't know when we are happy raises the disturbing possibility that you and I are wildly happy right now. I hope my wife doesn't find out. What's happiness doing in the Declaration of Independence anyway? The original phrase is "lives, liberties, and estates," a brief catalog of man's inherent rights that appears several times in John Locke's Second Treatise of Government. Locke was one of the Enlightenment's foremost proponents of natural law and the rights it naturally bestows, rights that are so much a part of our nature nothing can take them away, and we can't get rid of them. There were other important natural law theorists, such as Hugo Grotius, Samuel von Pufendorf, Jean-Jacques Burlamaqui. America's patriotic thinkers relied mostly on Locke because he argued the case for people's right to dissolve their government. Also, he was easier to spell. When Thomas Jefferson drafted the Declaration of Independence, he was referring directly to Chapter 9 of the Second Treatise, where Locke says that men are willing to join in society for the mutual preservation of their lives, liberties, and estates, which I call by the general name property. Every educated person understood the reference. Moral philosophy not yet having been replaced by civics in the educational curriculum. Many educated persons must have wondered about Jefferson's substitution of laughs for land. The fact that property wasn't mentioned in the Declaration of Independence still seems odd. The French Revolution's Declaration of the Rights of Man lists property second only to liberty, and the French revolutionaries had less respect for other people's property, and less property, than did the signers of the Declaration of Independence. Jefferson may have been trying to convey the idea that our new nation wasn't going to be a European kind of place. America wouldn't be parceled into aristocratic estates kept intact by a primogenitor and entail. Entail is a legal restriction on property, usually land, limiting its inheritance to linear descendants of the owner, and primogenitor is a further restriction that leaves out the girls in the family. Entail was necessary to preserve the power, formerly military, later economic, of the holders of the titles of nobility, which titles the U.S. Constitution would soon ban. Entail was in bad odor in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. Rationalist thinkers of the day were ashamed of inherited class distinctions, even sometimes especially, if they were so distinguished. Entailed estates were considered to be the ground from which grew the twisted family tree of peerage, occupied by the serpent who urged the rotten fruit of birthright upon Edenic mankind. The metaphor is over-fertilized, perhaps, but, said Tom Paine in Common Sense, original sin and hereditary succession are parallels, dishonorable rank, inglorious connection. Nowadays, when the British royal family is mostly blog fare and titled Frogs and Wops are of no interest to anyone but Vanity Fair editors, we wonder at the fuss over entail. Yet in the late 1700s, Georgia went so far as to pass a law against such laws, attempting to keep the privileged few from monopolizing the broad cotton fields of Terra. Never mind that for every free household in Georgia, the state had approximately 13,000 acres of unpopulated land. And Scarlett O'Hara's father was a bog Irish upstart who won the joint in a poker game. More than a decade after America had declared its unentailed independence and made pretensions of nobility illegal, Jefferson was still railing against transgenerational claims on property. In a letter to James Madison, he wrote, "The earth belongs in usufruct to the living." The italics are Jefferson's, and usufruct is the legal right to use and enjoy something, pursue happiness with it, during one's lifetime. Tom Paine would make the point again in his 1791 pamphlet, Rights of Man. Man has no property in man, neither has any generation a property in the generations that are to follow. Even Jane Austen would comment on the issue. In Pride and Prejudice, she has the silly Mrs. Bennet say, of the rules that decrees precisely who inherits what, "There is no knowing how estates will go once they come to be entailed." A remark that advocates of various environmental and conservationalist entails upon land might want to ponder. All these proponents of liberty versus heredity were taking their cue from Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, published, appropriately enough, in 1776. Smith wrote that the laws of entail are founded upon the most absurd of all suppositions, the supposition that every successive generation of men have not an equal right to the earth and to all that it possesses. America, as a place for fresh starts, has illustrious intellectual credentials. Not that we'd know it by looking at America's uncouth frontiersmen, woebegone backwoods pioneers, seedy homesteaders, giddy 49ers, illiterate cowboys, huddled masses of immigrants, and internet startup wingnuts. Pursuit of happiness also may have supplanted property in the Declaration of Independence because of definitional concerns. Locke died in 1704 when estates, which I call by the general name property, was still synonymous with land, and land was still synonymous with riches. Until Adam Smith succeeded in improving the world's understanding of economics, if he ever did, land was considered to be the only ultimate source of profit. The Declaration was written by Thomas Jefferson, but it was revised and edited by John Adams and Benjamin Franklin. Jefferson was a devotee of property in the sense of land and chattel, of animal and other kinds. But Adams, although a farmer, had no Jeffersonian vision of America as a pure agrarian society. Perhaps this was because Adams, unlike Jefferson, made a living from his farm. Adams and Franklin understood that trade, manufacture, and finance would be as significant in America as real estate. And Franklin had a personal interest in a type of ownership different from a land title, ownership of what we would come to call intellectual property. It was not coincidental to Franklin's influence that the power to approve patent rights would be granted in Article I of the forthcoming Constitution, and that the first act passed by the new Congress of the United States would concern patent law. Jefferson was often concerned about money, but Franklin and Adams were actually thinking about it. Still, we can understand why, for reasons of popularity and taste, the rights in the Declaration of Independence aren't listed as life, liberty, and stinking wealth. Roger Pilon, chief constitutional scholar at the Libertarian Cato Institute in Washington, D.C., believes there was another reason that property rights were handled with delicacy in the Declaration of Independence. Pilon concludes that Jefferson detected a flaw in the logic of Locke's unalienable rights. Property has to be alienable, in a legal sense, or you can't sell it. If we lived in a country where property was unalienable, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak would still have the pocket calculator that they sold to raise the money to start Apple. Therefore, when we go to work, there's nothing on the screen of the computer that doesn't exist at the job we don't have, because we're still farming the 20-acre tobacco patch that our ancestors gypped the Indians out of for beads and trinkets the last time anybody was allowed to buy anything, in the reign of George III. Property is an important aspect of the pursuit of happiness. Pilon says the Founding Fathers would have considered this materialistic side of happiness to be, as the Founding Fathers like to say, self-evident. Try paying your mortgage with a hug, though that's what the U.S. government is helping some people do these days. The authors of the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Federalist Papers, and the other sources of the American idea of freedom had a materialistic philosophy of independence, and they knew enough philosophy to know that they did. Jefferson, Franklin, Adams, Hamilton, Madison, et al., did not believe that American independence was the same as the independence preached by the so-called Cynic philosophers of ancient Greece. The Cynics held that independence lay in individual autarky, or rigid self-sufficiency. Diogenes was said to have been elated to discover he could drink from his cupped hands and dispense with his mug. But this shows that even the most ascetic pursuit of happiness involves consideration of the material world. And it shows that Diogenes was a dope who had to found a whole school of philosophy to figure out how to get a puddle to his face. Diogenes lived in a barrel. Whose barrel? Jefferson, Franklin, and Adams would have asked. There was nothing cynical about America's founding fathers, in any sense of the word, but nothing naive either. Pilon maintains that pursuit of happiness replaced property in the Declaration of Independence, not to denigrate material wealth, but to expand the idea of materialism. America was established as a way for Americans to make and do things. What sort of things Americans make and do, and whether these things lead to great riches, pious satisfactions, or transitory pleasures is nobody's business but our own. America's political institutions are supposed to be the machinery for our making and doing. America is a tool. America is the only place on earth or in history created in order to be both free and teleological. Teleology is the idea that phenomena are guided by a purpose. America is. But, and here's what's new, we Americans get to individually, personally, separately decide on any purpose we want. What's the point of other nations? It's something of a historical mystery. Conquering the world seems to be a purpose for some nations, fortunately not too many, and fortunately not too often, and most fortunately they always fail. Maybe nations arise to provide their citizens with mutual protection against external and internal threats. If this were the usual case, world history would read like an account of the interrelations of the cantons of Switzerland. Certain nations seem to exist strictly to torment their neighbors, or their citizens, or both. Other nations are simply there. Notice how in Paris people go to cafes and just sit around all day being French. Or, if they prefer to sit around all night, they can be Spanish and not have dinner until 11 p.m. A friend of mine once said about the rural Turks that they're so lazy they get up at 4 in the morning to have more time to do nothing. It gives an American the heebie-jeebies. We have to be making and doing. Albeit, what we make is often a mess, and what we do is often our undoing. Lately, we've added being to making and doing. What Americans are being is famous or infamous. There's no longer a distinction. Or fabulous, or centered, or self-actualized, or spiritual, or eco-conscious, or, frequently, real fat. Anyway, we Americans are very, very busy, and we owe it all to three little words in our Declaration of Independence. Or maybe that's wrong. Maybe Jefferson, Franklin, and Adams were just happy. Jefferson was famously uxorious. Perhaps his wife, Martha, slipped up to Philadelphia for a dirty weekend. And Franklin landed the Declaration of Independence printing contract, and Adams was working his way through a cask of Madeira. The Declaration's first draft might have read, "Pursuit of Nookie and Graft, and I'll drink to that." If it had gone to press this way, we'd be a different people, less busy and less happy, and more inclined to say such things to each other as, "Wealthy birthday," "Drunken days are here again," and "Sexually aroused to meet you." Four, the happy realization that all freedoms are economic freedoms, and failure is an option. The free market is the greatest repository of our freedoms. Economic freedom is the freedom we exercise most often and to the greatest extent. Freedom of speech is important, if you have anything to say. I've checked the internet, nobody does. Freedom of belief is important, if you believe in anything. I've watched reality TV, and I can't believe it. Freedom of assembly is important if you're going to an assembly. Most people are going to the mall, and at the mall they exercise economic freedom. We have the cow of economic freedom. Do we take the cow to market and trade her for the magic beans of bailout and stimulus? When we climb that beanstalk, we're going to find a giant government at the top. Are we going to be as lucky as Jack the Giant Killer was? I'm not sure Jack himself was that lucky with his giant killing. That's Jack's version. My guess is that Jack spent years being investigated by giant subcommittees, and now Jack's paying a giant tax on his beanstalk bonus. The free market is not a creed or an ideology that political conservatives, libertarians, and Ayn Rand acolytes want Americans to take on faith. The free market is simply a measurement. The free market tells us what people are willing to pay for a given thing at a given moment. That's all the free market does. The free market is a bathroom scale. We may not like what we see when we step on the bathroom scale, but we can't pass a law making ourselves weigh 165. Liberals and leftists think we can. The free market gives us only one piece of information, but it's important information. We ignore it at our peril, the way the leaders of the old Soviet bloc did. They lost the Cold War not just because of troops or tanks or Star Wars missile shields. Even Reagan and Thatcher couldn't win the Cold War by themselves. They needed allies, and the allies were Bulgarian blue jeans. The Soviets lost the Cold War because of Bulgarian blue jeans. The free market was attempting to inform the Kremlin that Bulgarian blue jeans didn't fit, were ugly and ill-made, and nobody wanted them at any price. People wouldn't wear Bulgarian blue jeans, literally, not to save their lives. But the Kremlin didn't listen, and the Berlin Wall came